Welcome to the Fangled Cast, brought to you by the folks at Fangled Group, the strategy-first marketing and sales consultancy helping take your company to the next level and beyond. We help our clients convert every touch into voracious advocates for their brand. Everybody, welcome back to the Fangled Cast. Today is a sort of a new friend on the block for me, a gentleman named David Allison, and I say gentleman because he's Canadian. Otherwise, I'd just say this guy I met. And please, audience, don't hold it against him. He'll be speaking English in the Canadian form, and there'll be maybe subtitles that you'll be able to figure out what the heck he's talking about. David is a super interesting guy because he's here today to try to convince you, and he may, that demographics are nonsense. And without me screwing up his bio, as you all know, I don't read intros. So David, please tell the Fangled Cast crew and everyone who watches us and that one guy who hates us who you are and what you do.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me over. Nice place you have here. It's always nice to, you know, visit and see what other people's lives are all about. How do I introduce myself? Well, first off, my name is David Allison. I'm the founder of something called the Value Graphics Project. We'll get into that more in a little bit. I spent most of my life in the marketing world and tried to help clients figure out how to get a group of people to do things you wanted them to do. And we always use demographics to try and do that because millennials, as we all know, are all the same. And right, they avocado toast. We remember the jokes. Boomers, no good with technology whatsoever because they're boomers, they're old. So it just didn't seem right. It didn't seem logical in a world where, you know, nobody acts their age anymore. Gender doesn't really dictate what we do. Just because you've been to university doesn't mean you're smart. So it was time for a new system. And when we started doing some research on this around the world, we're up to 600,000 surveys we've done around the planet now, it became blaringly obvious how terrible demographics really are at describing a group of people and with any kind of similarities whatsoever. I'll give you one quick stat and then I'll end this supposed self-introduction. Millennials around the world, and remember, this is more accurate than you need for a PhD from Harvard. Millennials only agree with each other on anything 15% of the time, which means 85% of the time they're absolutely unalike. So if you're happy with a 85% wastage on a dollar you're spending against the target audience, then carry on. If not, we have a better way.
Before we move on, the demographics is one of those words that everybody uses. And if you ask people to define it, you get a different definition from every person you ask. How do you, in the frame of our conversation today, how are you defining demographics?
Well, there's a fairly standard list of things that would qualify as a demographic label. Age, income, gender, marital status, number of kids, whether you've got an MBA or a BA. I mean, a great sort of ballpark way of talking about it is things you can see about a person. Like, okay, I can tell that someone's, you know, they're an older person, they're a younger person. That's not actually entirely true because you can't tell how wealthy someone is based on looking at them or whether they're white collar or blue collar, but it's basically just descriptive labels. And this is the problem. We've been using descriptive labels in a way where we think they tell us something about those people other than the label.
So could we say that a demographic in today's definition is sort of a pseudoscience stereotype?
Absolutely results in stereotypes for sure, because that's where all of these different problems are facing in the world have their roots, right? Ageism, sexism, racism, homophobia. This is all demographic lenses we're using to look at the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like stereotypes because they're kind of a shortcut, but it turns out that they're not that beneficial to us in the business world.
Well, they're a good shortcut in some sense, but in the business world, no. I mean, if you're happy with continuing on spending your money with an ROI of potentially 15, 16% targeting millennials. And by the way, all the labels, all the demographic labels are about the same. If you average them out, it's about 10% similarity within any one of those groups. That means we're wasting 90% of our money when we target people based on what we think we know about them demographically.
Let's get an example of a demographic process failure that you as an organization with what you do were able to turn around in a different way. A company that's been following the demographic model for years wasn't going anywhere. And then what we're going to be talking about, which is what you guys do, how that made that change.
Let me break that into two parts.
Okay.
I have a great sort of origin story about how we've stumbled across this in the first place. My marketing company that I owned for a decade was a specialist organization that helped large-scale real estate developers with big condo towers and resort developments and office buildings and things like this. So they would give us a description of their target audience. These are the people who are going to come and buy these condos or move into this resort community or whatever we were doing. So then we go and spend a couple million bucks and we try and get people to buy or rent or lease or whatever we were doing. And the nice thing about the real estate development industry is that there's a closed loop. It's like 2 years later, you go over to the condo building that's been built and you can see who bought there. And so you can kind of get a gut sense of how correct you were. So for the longest period of time, the target audience for all those condo towers and resort communities could be summed up this way: wealthy baby boomers. That's who everybody wanted to chase because they were wealthy and they were baby boomers. And so it was probably time for them to get out of that single family house in the suburb and move to a condo. So it seemed to make a ton of sense. So we go and do this and we go and we'd meet these people 2 years later. And there was so many kinds of people in the room. Where were all these other people coming from? Why were they there? We weren't talking to them. We hadn't bought media for them. We hadn't created campaigns for them, but they showed up anyway. But you know what? Real estate here in Vancouver and certain parts of the United States where we've been working, it was like falling off a log. So it was, we just kept doing it. It was like, oh, well, that worked. You know, let's just do it again and again and again. So when I sold my company, I decided I was going to see if I could figure that mystery out. And that's where this journey began. I was starting to do some research and figure out what is it that gets people to make a decision about doing something. And this is where you dive into the behavioral sciences and say, okay, how do people make decisions? You talk to psychiatrists, psychologists, neuroscientists are on board with this, sociologists, all the behavioral sciences, they all agree on this one central principle, that what we value determines everything we do. Mm-hmm. All our decisions, our behaviors, and even in fact, our emotions have their roots in what's most important in our life. Kind of makes sense, right? If family is the most important thing in your life and somebody comes along and says, this thing I want you to do is going to be amazing for your family, you're going to run after that. And if something comes along that doesn't look like it's going to be the right decision for your family, you'll run away from that thing. Mm-hmm. But it turns out we're absolutely hardwired and it's the only way we make decisions about anything. So values determine what we do. So I started looking and saying, well, cool. We should know the values of our target audiences then. If we're trying to get people to do stuff, that's what they're going to use as a decision-making tool. And there wasn't one. There is no way, there hadn't been a way until we started to build the Value Graphics database. There isn't a way to understand the shared values of a target audience. So we decided to solve that problem. And 6 years later, here we are. And we're able to do that now in 180 different countries around the world.
Yeah, I had heard an interesting scenario very similar to that. There was a gentleman that moved into an Indian guy, moved into a neighborhood with tons of Indians. And he thought, if I build a restaurant that serves Indian street food, I've got a built-in audience because all of these Indian people live within so many, you know, minutes of the location. And he opened up and almost no Indian people eat at his place. And you'd ask him why. And he said, well, it turns out Indian street food is what people make at home all the time. They're not going to go out and eat that. They want luxury food when they go to a restaurant. But local white people, black people, every other demographic was fascinated by this new style of food and they love it and they don't know how to make it at home. So I built a restaurant for an audience and I got a different audience.
Absolutely. So I'll go, let's talk about that. I'll go a step further.
Sure.
What I would say is that the non-Indian customers that he was finding in his Indian street food restaurant, there were only a certain kind of people who were interested in this.
Absolutely.
They would be coming there for a particular set of values that they saw that would benefit if they decided to do this. So it's a cuisine they're unfamiliar with. So there could be that one of the threads that connects his customers is adventurousness.
Yes.
Is experience hunting. So one of the values, there's only 56 things that drive our decisions. So one of them is experiences. Mm-hmm. So this audience, I'm guessing, would rank really high for experiences in terms of what values are driving their decision-making process. There's going to be other folks who are black or white or other colors of the rainbow who aren't going there because they don't really want anything so different. They're actually more perhaps the value of tradition is driving them, and they would rather just have the traditional food that they're used to having, and they don't necessarily want a big crazy experience when they go out for dinner. So there's a great example of how two different groups of people who you would look at demographically, if you look at them valuographically, you can see a common thread that crosses across all of those things about age and income and race and all that other stuff.
It's really interesting. I'm even wondering, not to get too far off the subject, because I want to get right back to what we're talking about, how the value mapping could benefit companies in terms of profiling and understanding and benchmarking positions. For example, for the global trade world, the same guys that will go and experiment and get excited about a new food, in my opinion, have a much higher possibility of prospecting and selling goods into foreign markets than the people who would refuse to go in there because they don't make hamburgers.
Where's the McDonald's? Yeah, it's a truth. I mean, any group of people. Okay, so let's back up. And this is really quite fascinating when you start thinking about the world like this. And I'll apologize to everybody in advance, because once you do think about the world like this, you can't unsee it. So I'm about to change.
Do I need to light up the nerd alert signal? No,
please don't. Please don't. Okay. But the reason a group of people can be defined as a target audience is because of some behavior, right? These are the people who made a decision to do this, or these are the people who decided to eat at that Indian restaurant, or who are good at global trade and have careers in global trade, or are institutional investors on Wall Street in a particular hedge fund. So if you can define a group of people like that, and we understand, based on hardcore science from all over the world and all the human behavior disciplines, that the only reason people decide to do anything is because of their values, well then A plus B, the reason those people are a target audience in the first place is because some set of values in common drove them to make that decision or those series of decisions to become the person who's in that audience. Mm-hmm. So what we do is we detect that.
Okay, so we started the conversation about this apartment complex where you marketed it and spent all of their money to bring in people who never showed up. Hmm. And other people somehow got there and bought and yeah. loved what they bought. So now you've got that finding. Yeah. How does that apply to a new client that comes to you who says, we think our target market is this. How can you help me?
Right. So let's just complete the loop on the real estate story first. Sure. So what was happening, what we didn't understand, was that we were saying stuff and doing things in that campaign that were triggering certain values out there in the world. So inadvertently, we were attracting a group of people. We looked around the room and demographically, they didn't resemble each other or the people we thought we were talking to. But if we had been able to understand their values, they were the same people. Mm-hmm. That's why they were there. It was their values that brought them there. We just didn't know we were doing it. We just happened to be saying stuff that they were like, that's for me. That's the place I'm going.
And you were lucky that your message was hitting those people, because so many times we get so tight in a target on a market that we're only talking to the people we think we want to talk to. And that message would have rang true for somebody else.
Yeah, exactly. So why not know in advance what those things, those signals are that are going to get those people to come? Because here's what happens. You're far more efficient with your spend. The amount of money you're wasting on demographic assumptions is reduced drastically. And you're able to plan your thing, build your product, your service, your brand in a way that is going to trigger a set of values, because you know what the values are of the people who you're trying to trigger to get to come and do your thing. So if you know that going in, then you're not spending all this time guessing and going, oh, I'm the customer whisperer, and I think they're going to be this. So why guess? Why not just know what's going to move the needle?
Have you found, you know, people that years and years and years in marketing that have been doing this intuitively and didn't know that's what they were doing?
You know, I think some people are maybe better at guessing it than others, but here's the problem. We've been so defined by demographic categories for so long that even if you've got a good gut instinct for this stuff, your gut instinct was being truncated. You think about it this way. Here's a loaf of bread. And we've been slicing the world like this and going, you know, men, women, rich, poor, young, old, 18 to 24, have an MBA, work in finance, all these different demographic slices. And then we pick out the slices of bread we want and we say, that's our target audience. But if we actually start looking at what's the through line, what's the connecting values that go across all those things and slice the bread this way, what we always find out is that we have a baguette. that this is a much longer slice that goes beyond those demographics that we thought. So you might go into this exercise and say, yeah, my target audience is 18 to 24 year olds, men who are, you know, just finishing college and they're single and they have this and blah, 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 whatever. So great. We find out what is getting them excited about your value proposition, your brand, your offer, whatever it is. But that's also going to work for people in other demographic categories. Yeah. It's not exclusive to them. So why not understand who they are this way instead of limiting yourself like this and saying, that's the only ones I want.
And by the way, this is a gluten-free bread. This podcast is known as being gluten-free. So it was a special bread that he was talking about. If you're one of my gluten-free audience members. That was one of the jokes when I first started this. I was going to promote it to the Fangold Cast, the only gluten-free podcast. And three of my friends who are now listening are going, that jerk, he said he wasn't going to do it. So let's kind of move on to the next part then. So in an engagement, a client comes to you where we have product X and we're really looking to bring it to market. How does an engagement look where I would use these, the results of all of these surveys that we've talked about, 600,000 surveys to take my business to the next level? And cool. Reach the right value.
Thank you. That's a nice question that allows me to brag a little bit about what we do. So
that was the plan.
Take advantage of that. So for whatever audience you're trying to understand, what we do is go and find a small group of those people, a statistically accurate sample of that group of people. It could be generally somewhere between 13 and 1800 people, depending on how complex the group is and all kinds of other boring statistical things. So we get this group of people. We ask them a couple questions, usually just around 10. And that information, that's what we call an unlocking survey. So those answers to the unlocking survey around a particular audience of people, that tells us where to go looking in our benchmark study, which is now 600,000 surveys strong. As I've mentioned, more accurate than you need for a PhD from Harvard, covers 180 countries. And that unlocking survey, those results tell us where to go in there and pull out the corresponding lookalike data for people just like that little group we just talked to. So let's say, for example, that we were hired by the United Nations to help them understand a very particular group of doctors that we've given the nickname the Global Medics. Now, there was a set of characteristics around these doctors that's too long to go into, but they're a very specific kind of doctor that the UN wanted to understand, the UN Foundation wanted to understand. So we went and talked to a small group of them, asked them a couple of our secret questions, and that allowed us to go into the benchmark study and pull out which of the 56 core human values they had in common, which are the things that are driving their decisions, behaviors, and emotions. So if we look at this chart, we can see, for example, the turquoise, turquoise dots are the general population of the United States. So that's everybody else. The white dots are the global medics. Look at how much more important, for example, community is. It's at the very top of the list for the global medics, and it doesn't even show up in the top 10 list for the general population. It's not, it's on the 56 most important, 56 values for the all Americans, but not in the top 10. Right at the very top of the top 10 for the global medics is community. So they're very motivated by anything that's about building, fostering, maintaining, growing their community and their sense of community. So there's a thing, if you're trying to talk to the global medics, as they were defined by the UN Foundation, talking to them about how doing this thing we would like you to do is going to make you part of a community. It's going to help strengthen the communities that you care about. It's a very powerful message for this group of people. Whereas for the rest of America, not so much. For the rest of America, if we go down the list, we can see, for example, belonging. Look at that turquoise dot way the freaking out there on the right-hand side. That's the number one most important thing to all Americans. Belonging, even more important than family. I want to know that I belong, that I'm part of something bigger than me, that I get what's going on around me. I don't feel like a stranger. It's one of the reasons I think we see this polarization going on in American life right now is people belong to a camp. And they're loath to let that membership in that camp go away because they define themselves based on where they belong.
Gotcha.
That's what we're seeing there. But not so much for these global medics. I'm going to guess that if we put a bunch of them in a room and start asking them about which side of some of these issues they're on, they're not going to be as polarized as the general population is.
Interesting. So then from that data, and we start to look at the, you know, the community, we look at lower levels, that's when the marketing team starts to craft a message that speaks to and walks away from those things that are either important or unimportant within the value structure of
It all kind of depends what you're trying to do. So I'll give you a bit more context about the United Nations Foundation. So they wanted to talk to this group of people because they had some of them in their data set already who had been really good donors to a particular humanitarian cause that was all about buying mosquito nets to give away in countries where if you do not sleep under a mosquito net, you can still get bit by a mosquito and die from malaria. Handing out mosquito nets is saving lives in these countries where malaria-borne or mosquito-borne malaria is still a massive, massive problem. So they wanted to find more doctors like this who could also become good donors and parts of the family who are helping out with this particular cause. So going to them saying, great, community is huge. So now they can say, how can we craft these programs? This isn't just about a marketing message. Perhaps this is about introducing these doctors who are donating to the communities where these nets are being distributed so they feel some sense of connection. How about these doctors get connected to each other? So there's a community of doctors here in the United States who care deeply about this issue, and they're swapping information about this and about other tropical diseases they may be interested in or involved with research around. How can we build this sense of community around our offering? Yes, the messaging as well, but the reward programs. Maybe if you give us a certain amount of money, I'm making this up. This isn't anything that they decided to do. Because that's proprietary. They decided to do what they decided to do, but they could have said, what if you give us a certain amount of money and we will actually arrange for you to adopt a village, and you're going to have a twice a year, there's going to be some sort of an exchange of information, maybe a Zoom call, if that's possible, depending on where this community is and what their access to the internet's all about. How can we use the things we know you care about most as a way to design the entire program? The brand, the positioning, the messaging, the reward systems, the HR. Who should we be hiring internally here to be part of the way we talk to this group of people? What do we say when we answer the phones when one of these people call us? What's the message that goes on their Christmas card? There's no message or touch point too small or too large that doesn't get incrementally or exponentially more important and more powerful from knowing what these people care about. And that's what we can tell you. So that's an example in the not-for-profit world.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the strategies back in my days living in Brazil, when we were offering products throughout South America, each of the countries obviously has their own personality. Argentinians are not similar to Brazilians, much like people from the Bayou of Louisiana don't know how to hang out with people from the south side of Chicago.
Yeah.
It's a very different world. And one of the values that we knew always worked in getting one of the countries to start to deal with the product was a certain level of cultural competitiveness between the two. If you tell a businessman in Argentina, for example, well, I don't understand what your resistance is. They're making millions. The Brazilians know how to do it. They immediately would find a way to make it happen in Argentina,
right?
Or otherwise. Where does that sort of competitive value that I want to be better than,
right,
or feel superior fall in your scale?
It's a great question, because people get behaviors and values mixed up all the time. Mm-hmm. So the behavior you're describing is competition.
Right.
We're able to trigger that behavior. Now, different people will behave that way for different reasons. It might be that one guy that you talked to who started to suddenly get all competitive was because of social standing. He wanted to be the guy in his circle that everybody goes, wow, exactly. You just like showed those Argentinians a thing or two, didn't you? And someone else, it might be, financial security. You may have, in the way you phrase that, said to him, listen, if you do this, you're going to be a lot more financially secure. Personally, you don't have to worry about cash anymore. You don't have to worry about your cash flow, your family's. It might be about family. Your family will be well looked after. It could be that those were the values that were being triggered by this opportunity to be competitive. You were planting a seed that could have triggered all kinds of different values in different people, which is great. You knew enough to do that. But what we're able to layer on top of that is, for this group of people, if you could also say, if you do this, those guys over there, you're going to look like a rock star to all your cohort here. They'll be like, oh yeah, that's exactly what I'm looking for, is social standing. And they would have gotten even more competitive, even faster. Whereas this other group over here, what they needed to hear is, this is going to improve your financial security. This is going to make sure that your family is safe for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. And that would get them to be all competitive at another level.
Interesting. Interesting stuff. You had prepared, there was a second chart that you were going to show. Yeah.
So I didn't want anybody to think that all we do is a warm, fuzzy, save the world things. But I do want to, before I go on, point out that that's very much one of our core drivers here, is we like to see ourselves as Robin Hood. So we work with very large organizations around the world and charge a very fair price. And then we take that money and we use it to give away data to organizations like the United Nations and the Environmental Defense Fund and some of the other stuff that we get to do. So
fantastic.
Everybody gets to benefit from this.
Yeah, so do you ever give any of that money to the Andrew Fund?
The Andrew Fund is it's on our list of organizations to look at for the coming fiscal year.
Yeah, I hear they do great things.
I've heard the same. So here's another chart that shows the general population of the United States compared to institutional investors for a particular Wall Street hedge fund. And I'm not going to tell you which one. So when we start looking at institutional investors, for anybody who's listening or watching today and doesn't understand or is unfamiliar with the term, these are guys who work at these big, big, giant funds like the Harvard pension fund. And their job every day is to figure out, okay, I got another $10 million I got to get rid of here. I got to go invest it over here. I got to go invest it over there. So they have a set of criteria they have to follow. They got a boss breathing down their neck saying, you got to get this done by Friday. It's got to be smart. It's got to do all these things. And their lives, their success rises or falls based on the smart decisions they make about where to invest that stuff. So that's an institutional investor. And guess who's chasing these folks? Every hedge fund on the planet. Mm-hmm. So all day long, ping, 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 ping. Those are the incoming decks into their email saying, look at us, look at our, give us the money. We're smart. We've got great managers and look at our performance for the past 6 years. And by the way, everything that's happened in the past is, you know, the safe harbor statement has nothing to do with might happen in the future. There's no guarantee. Like so we show you all this stuff and then we say, but you got to ignore that because it's really not going to, we can't.
It was a great video game years ago, Sonic the Hedge Fund.
Yeah, exactly. So this is institutional investors compared to the general population of the United States. If you are at a hedge fund and you want to try and get these folks to pay attention to you, this is the stuff, not just about their job, but in their lives that have caused them to become institutional investment placement officers, because our values make us do the things we do. And so we can detect what they have in common. And now you need to connect the dots between the messaging about your hedge fund and the stuff we know that's driving their decisions. So what do we know about them? In this case, they're sort of that nice green color. I don't know what to call that. We're going to call it green for today. So look at how less important belonging is to them than it is to the general population. Trying to say, you should do this, you should look at our hedge fund because you're going to be part of the family and you're going to fit in here, you're going to be one of us. Like, no, what else you got? Look down at financial security, though. These guys around themselves, not just whether or not they're making a smart decision, their own financial security is incredibly important in the way they make decisions about everything. So their future rises and falls based on this, how smart their decision is. And it's a constant driver for them. Is this the one that's going to impact me and my personal financial security in a good way or a bad way? Mm-hmm. How can you talk to them about the stability of your fund, about how the management team has been working at this fund for the last 40 years and everything's been fine. And while we can't point you to a particular set of statistics that guarantee your returns in the future, it's a pretty safe bet, us, compared to these other guys that just started up 6 months ago with some kind of crazy quant mathematical formula in the background that you don't forget to understand. We've got stability on our side, which means your financial security is far better off. You look down at the bottom, those four green dots that are floating there on their own, those are things that show up for the institutional investors that do not show up in the top 10 for the general population. Things like personal responsibility. These guys like to know that they're the deciders. Mm-hmm. I did this. So don't do it for them. Set stuff up in a way, your messaging, your consumer pathing, your decision pathing, all of that stuff. Let them feel like they're the ones, don't let them feel like it. Make them the ones who are driving this decision home. They want to be the alpha who said, I made this decision. It was my responsibility and I did it. Experiences, wealth, upward mobility. There's an interesting one. These guys work with money, other people's money, all day long. Now, they're not the lions of Wall Street. They do not have Rolexes the size of dinner plates. We don't need to have a bake sale for them. They're doing just fine. But they're all day talking to these hedge fund guys who are getting like $1 million bonuses at Christmas just because they showed up and kept their nose clean. They're looking for some sense of upward mobility. That's an incredibly important thing to them. They see what true wealth can buy, and they wish they could be those guys. Now, you can't, as a hedge fund, say to them, like, hey, we're going to slip something to you under the table here. But what you can say to them is that this is by choosing to work with us and invest in our fund. How else can we show you that upward mobility will be the result, that you're going to feel like you're moving in the right direction? You're going to be hanging with the right guys here. And, you know, we are who we surround ourselves with.
This is really, really fascinating stuff. It's brilliant that we can cover every total aspect of what you do in less than 30 minutes. But the reality is we're just, you know, I hate the analogy, but truly just the tip of the iceberg on the power of this work. And I think that we've really justified the danger of the demographic as the sole source of trying to grow your business.
I hope so. Let me give you the big wrap up then.
Perfect.
Just turned in or got confused by all my rambly nonsense. Demographics used to work. There was a time in our history where men had to behave in a certain way, women had to behave in a certain way. If you were young, you did certain things. You were old, you did other stuff. Rich people had a role, poor people had a role. And if we didn't all behave ourselves, there were prices to pay. Your little village back in the African savannah would just be wiped out by the next village down the street because nobody was doing the things they were supposed to do. You weren't pulling your weight. You weren't surviving. But today, with this kooky things come along and changed our world called technology. And now we don't need to be anybody for anybody. We can basically live however we want, yet we're still using these outdated ideas about who people are as a way to understand the people around us. So it doesn't work. We got the stats to back it up. More so, even more important, we touched on this very briefly at the beginning. If we continue to perpetuate these demographic ways of looking at the world, we're only adding fuel to the fire for racism, homophobia, ageism, sexism, all these demographic social problems that we're grappling with around the planet right now. We have to dismantle these ideas that demographics are somehow true, other than for what the label themselves is. You got a room full of 18-year-olds. The only thing they have in common, they're 18. That's it. Nothing else. And now we have a way to replace them with a segmentation system that's based on what we care about, what makes us human, what drives our humanity, it's our values. And it's got to be a better way forward for all of us, for businesses, more effective, 8 times more effective, mm-hmm. and for the world at large. It'll help erase so many of these problems that we're staring down the barrel of and trying to figure out how to get out to the other side, to mix my metaphors terribly.
I got you. I gotta thank you again for coming on. I love having a guest on that gets me thinking in new ways, and you're definitely one of them. So I really appreciate your time today coming on the show. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me over.
And for all of you at home, you want to reach out to David, you'll be able to look in the notes. His picture is not up at the post office. He's not wanted by the FBI. He's wanted by businesses that really are looking for better ways of reaching their audience. And if you enjoyed the Fangled Cast, remember you're supposed to subscribe. You can go down here and hit the subscription button. You can like it. You can share it with a friend. If the demographic of the people that you know is 80 and above, fax them a copy of the video if you can figure out how to do that. And we will see you all on the next edition of the Fangled Cast. Thank you again, David, for coming.
Thanks for having me over. Take care, everyone.
Bye now.
The Fangled Cast is brought to you by the great people at the Fangled Group, where we help you convert every touch into voracious advocates for your brand.